Welcome to Saving the Game. This is Episode 3, The Crusader Archetype, recorded Friday, July 20th of 2012, with your hosts, Grant and Peter. Welcome to Saving the Game. My name is Grant.
And my name is Peter.
And today's episode is going to be about knights and crusaders and that crusader archetype. First, though, we've got one fairly significant bit of podcast news. Saving the Game is now available through the iTunes Store. So you can subscribe through the store to our podcast feed. You can review us on the iTunes Store, help us get new listeners, share us around through iTunes, all that good stuff. I'm not going to say, hey, give us 5 stars, but if you listen to the show and you use iTunes, stop by and give us an appropriate review. Help us get a little bit of attention if you think we deserve it. It would be a huge help for all of us.
Yeah, we would really appreciate honest feedback, anything that you've got to share with us comments-wise. If you give us a review that's lower, we would really appreciate it if you would pair that with some constructive criticism if you've got the time, so we can get better.
Yes. We're always looking for suggestions on how we can improve, how we can address topics that people are interested in. So please, if you're going to criticize, please make it constructive.
Yes.
So, Peter.
Yeah.
I hear there's a big sale on Steam.
Yeah, it's actually been going since last Thursday. It's winding down. According to the dates on the page, it's going to be ending on the 22nd, I believe. So we've only got 3 days left of that.
Awesome.
Including today.
Oh, yeah, of course. I have not bought anything off it this year, but what have you gotten so far?
I've gotten a couple of things. Gratuitous tank battles. I got a small indie RPG called Crater that apparently takes place in post-apocalyptic Sweden, so that should be interesting.
Heh.
Yeah, I'm kind of a sucker for tactical games, as anybody who reads my blog will know. Specifically, like, small squad kind of stuff.
Fallout Tactics, that sort of thing.
Yeah, Fallout Tactics. Jagged Alliance 2 is my favorite PC game of all time. It came out in 99 and I still play it regularly. I also picked up AI War Fleet Command Dear Esther, which I hear is kind of a neat adventure game.
Yeah, I've heard mixed reviews of Dear Esther.
Yeah, so have I. I've decided I just wanted to check it out. I got Legend of Grimrock way back at the beginning.
Oh, that looks awesome. I saw a review video of that and I immediately wanted to play it, but I'm into so much other stuff right now. There's a child on the way, and that's taking up a lot of time. But Minecraft also got its hooks in me again.
You know, I actually haven't given Minecraft a try yet, and I hear that makes me something of a Philistine in video gaming.
I don't know about that. I think you would enjoy it.
Well, I did play with Legos all the way through my childhood.
Yeah.
Occasionally still do.
It's an infinite supply of Legos that you have to go search for and risk zombies and spiders and skeletons and exploding cacti things with feet.
Exploding cacti things with feet. Oh, are those green, standy, four-legged,
yeah,
walking pillar things with the face that I've seen online?
Yes, those
are
creepers.
That's a Minecraft creeper.
Yes.
I've wondered what those were.
They have the best AI in the game. They try and just peer around corners at you and never take the most direct route. And then they sneak up behind you, hiss, and explode, like TNT. Which not only damages you, but destroys the blocks that you have built.
So they're suicide bombing crafty,
yeah,
attack cactuses with feet.
Yes. They're horrible.
That's certainly unique.
That's also why I tend to play Minecraft on peaceful, which I know makes me a wimp, but I'm more interested in the building and the collecting and the exploring and not the fighting. I have this ridiculously bad startle reflex and really high blood pressure, so I pass it off as a health concern.
Fair enough. You're going to have a kid in a matter of just a few weeks. I mean, the last thing that she needs is to lose her dad to a heart attack from Minecraft.
Yeah, tell me about it.
I'll back you up on the health thing, man. It's all good.
Yeah, but no, you should give Minecraft a try. It's well worth the money. I mean, it's got full mod support from the community, and they're still releasing updates for it.
Oh, it's kind of the Eastern European release it and keep it in development model, huh?
Yeah, pretty much.
I suppose that should just be the European, because aren't they based in Sweden?
Yes, they are.
I know that the studio is heavily, and especially the guy who created it, are heavily involved in charitable stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Every time there's a Humble Bundle, he's one of the top two.
Yeah.
You've got kind of a friendly rivalry with the other guy, or organization, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, Notch is a pretty cool dude. I've been playing actually the Technic Pack lately, which is a collection of mods that add a huge endgame to Minecraft. Minecraft has an ending, but it's not much of an ending.
Well, from what I understand, you don't really play Minecraft for the story.
No, there is no story. There's just stuff you can do that rolls the credits. The Technic Pack adds an enormous amount of automation, technology, up to and including an entire programming language within Minecraft.
Oh, wow.
It's crazy stuff. And that's what's got its hooks into me lately, is building massive automated factories and that sort of thing.
Cool.
It's good stuff. You really should give it a try at some point. If nothing else, I've been meaning to set up a Minecraft server at some point. I'll have to put some effort into that and get you on it.
I think with all the other projects you've got, that could probably safely be backburnered for a while, but I'll let you know when I get it. So, that keeping things in development actually sounds like one of the games that I've been flushing way too much time into lately, and that's Dungeons of Dreadmoor by the little independent studio Gaslamp Games.
I love that game.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've gotten a little bit of time into there. Did you know that they've got another expansion pack coming out at the beginning of August?
No.
Yeah, it's called Invasion of the Wizard Lands, I believe. They're going to add like a pocket dimension you can stuff all your crafting stuff in.
In fairness, I've not made it past level 3.
I have actually made it all the way to the bottom of the dungeon and killed Lord Dreadmoor, but that was with permadeath off and a lot of repeated attempting, so it doesn't really count.
No, no.
I think the furthest down I made it with permadeath on was like level 5 or 6, and by that point I had Realm of the Diggle Gods, so the dungeon was 15 levels deep instead of 10, so I didn't even make it halfway.
Yeah, I bought the big expansion pack sale at some point. I may have gotten it during the last summer sale, I'm not sure.
Well, and I mean, even if you buy that game at full price, it's still only $5, so it's...
Yeah, it's dirt cheap.
It's the best cost-to-playtime ratio on any game I have ever seen, ever.
It's not... Oh, what is that? What is that one on Steam? It's a rail simulator?
Oh, Railworks.
Railworks, yes. Railworks 3, where they have a special now where you can get Railworks and all of the expansions for only $1,000.
That's a lot of money to just pretend like you're driving a train.
Yeah, ridiculous.
I know they had the core game on sale for like $375 yesterday, but that was obviously with none of the DLC.
Yeah, and of course, that's not $3.75, is it?
No. I'm looking at the page for it now. They've got 70 items, 70.
Mm-hmm.
The least expensive one is $1.99. The most expensive one is $50. This is crazy. I mean, I can understand a lot of this is probably very accurate to the real terrain that you're driving the train through and probably very lovingly created, but where's the market for this?
I don't know. I really sometimes think Railworks started as an attempt to troll Steam and it just got out of hand.
It could have been. I mean, you know, actually, listeners, if any of you are a Railworks player, we would love to hear from you. What's the appeal of this? Because it just seems to me like trains just go in a straight line. They're on tracks.
Occasionally they curve. I don't know. I've never been a train guy anyway, though.
My dad is, but yeah, I'm really not either.
I don't know. It's a strange thing.
Totally leave the long, confused pauses in.
Oh, yeah. No. The long, confused pauses, this conversation about long, confused pauses, it's all staying in, I'm telling you.
Well, should we get to our topic here?
Yes, I think so. Our main topic for tonight, shockingly, is not about video games. We actually wanted to talk about knights and crusaders and the holy warrior archetype. There's actually two good pieces of scripture that we wanted to bring to the forefront today. Peter, you want to start us off with the one from the Old Testament?
Actually, I think I'll let you take that one and I'll take the one from John.
Okay. So this is 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 45, and the particular translation we're using here is the New International Version. David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied."
That's David talking to Goliath.
Yes.
And then the second one that we have is from John 15:13 from the American Standard Version. "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends."
So this topic, well, it was going to be a discussion.
Basically the paladin archetype.
Paladins and clerics, armored holy warriors. But the more we thought about it and talked about it, the more we realized that we were really sort of talking about two examples of a particular archetype, which is the Christian crusading knight. The knight in heavy armor, cross on his chest, on a crusade, doing good works with sword and shield.
Or possibly even the Arthurian knight-errant, too. Some of them would definitely fit the archetype.
Yeah, it's a little broader than the knight on a crusade, because there is the Arthurian legend, there's a number of others we'll get to, but the archetype really extends back even further than that, or at least the archetype of somebody going to war and doing violence in the name of God.
Yeah, and being right to do so.
Right.
And that's something we really want to stress, as we are talking about the times when it's not corrupted and when it's not somebody being a hypocrite. These people are actually following some cause that actually is just and actually is serving the interests of God and humanity, as opposed to using that as a justification for something that isn't good.
So there are a few biblical examples that we wanted to bring up first, because this really is an archetype that extends all the way back into biblical times.
And in fact, actually, you see a lot more of this archetype in the Old Testament than the New.
Yes, I was trying hard to think of any archetypes of it in the New Testament, and I couldn't really think of one. This is really something that's an Old Testament thing.
About the only thing that you can even get close on in the New Testament is you've got a few examples of Roman soldiers converting to Christianity, but they weren't reporting to a Christian order because no such thing existed at the time.
Right.
And you've got Simon the Zealot in Jesus' Apostles, but that was kind of something bad that he gave up to follow the Lord. Those are about as close as you get in the New Testament.
The Old Testament, though, is really pretty full of it. In fact, there's a book of the Bible, Judges, devoted to narrating the lives and accomplishments of a whole sequence of these holy warriors who save Israel time and time again and serve the cause of Israel and protect it as they settle in the land of Canaan.
Now, certainly the judges were more than just warriors. They actually functioned as, well, judges. But these people could definitely fight, and sometimes they employed some fairly creative tactics. I think one of the most dramatic examples of violence done in that book is the guy who sneaks into the king's tent and has the sword strapped to the inside of his leg because he's got one bad arm. Yeah, that was actually Ehud. You may or may not recognize that name from the Old Testament. It mentions that he was left-handed, which may have meant that he had some trouble with his right arm back then, or it may have just meant that he was a lefty and that was one of his more distinctive qualities. He went in to deal with the king of Moab, ostensibly to present tribute, and once he was alone, he pulled a hidden weapon and ran the guy through. It's stated outright that he was something of a tyrant. That's one of the earlier examples of righteous violence in the Bible.
Yep. Of course, even earlier than that, you had the ancient warriors who led the Israelites into Canaan and Judea, Joshua in particular.
Ah, yes, the famous battle at the walls of Jericho.
Yes, and then maybe most famous of all, King David. The verse we gave from 1 Samuel is, of course, David as a boy fighting Goliath, but really 1 and 2 Samuel are all about wars against the Philistines and other tribes in the area.
One of the more famous examples, of course, from the Old Testament, probably the most famous, was King David, who, even as a boy, was something of a warrior. In fact, one of the first notable things that we hear about him in the Bible is him taking down Goliath, a veteran Philistine warrior who was quite a bit larger than he was. I think if you go back and reference the old units of measurement, he was something like 6'5", which would have just been... First of all, that's tall these days. I'm 5'10", I've got a coworker that's 6'5", and the guy just towers over me. But
yeah, it's huge.
When you consider that David, first of all, he was probably just a teenager based on the earlier parts of the scripture, and second, that people just didn't really come that tall back then. This guy must have just seemed like an actual giant, like fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman giant.
There's a good chance that he was half again as tall.
Yeah,
as David.
Possibly even a little bit more so. I mean, it would have been an almost comical comparison between the two of them on the battlefield.
Yep.
Obviously, everybody knows how that fight went. Projectile weapons are a wonderful thing.
Yes, they are. And slings are surprisingly effective.
Yeah, it's not much of a stretch, especially given the scripture, to infer that David may have had just a little bit of help from God himself in that battle.
Of course. We've talked about these biblical examples, but the crusader archetype really arises from the European tradition in the dark and medieval ages of heavily armored knights fighting in the crusades. European histories are filled to the brim with stories and records of these knights. That makes up a lot of European history in that era.
Yeah, and it's about as romanticized as it gets.
Yes. It's romanticized and remembered in large part because Europe was heavily involved in the Crusades, and because it was the kings of nations who went on these Crusades and helped found a lot of the knightly orders and that sort of thing. Perhaps the best known individual crusader is probably King Richard III of England, also known as Richard the Lionhearted.
Who you may remember from the Robin Hood tales as the king that he's trying to hold out for until he can get back.
Yep.
When we were doing the pre-show on this, we ran across a very, if you kind of want a nice quick, and I do mean quick, only 10 minutes long, primer on the Crusades. We ran across a video series called Crash Course on YouTube that will be linked in the show notes that was just excellent.
Yep. I need to give a thank you to Noble Bear for bringing Crash Course to my attention.
Yeah. Just a fair warning, if you watch one of these, you're probably going to watch at least five before you walk away from the computer. They're kind of like Pringles. You really just can't eat one.
Yeah, they're fascinating and hilarious.
Surprisingly high production values for a YouTube series.
Oh, the production
series.
Values for it are amazing.
But one of the things that I found out about this from the series, actually, was the first Crusaders were actually more pilgrim than warrior. I believe they were pretty much armed just to deal with any of the incidental dangers of the ancient world along the way.
Pretty much. The pilgrimages to the Holy Land were really big business throughout Europe and throughout the Islamic world for centuries. The Islamic Empire had conquered the Holy Land really in, I believe, the 8th or 9th century. For several centuries, pilgrimages to the Holy Land were perfectly fine.
The Muslims in the area were actually really kind of happy about them because they were a wonderful source of basically economic growth. They brought in tax revenue because they would tax you for having another religion in the area. And they also did the same thing that tourism does today, which is just people, when they go someplace, bring money with them and use it to buy things that they need while they're there. So food, clothes, probably animals back then. It was just good for the local economy.
It was. What then happened is essentially there was a regime change and they made the mistake of sacking Jerusalem and kicking the Christians and Jews out of it. They quickly realized the error of their ways, but it was kind of too late by that point.
This will probably go down in history as one of the great bonehead decisions of all time.
Yeah. For various reasons, Pope Urban II wanted to tie the Christian nations closer together and help consolidate the power of the papacy over these nations. And there's no better way to do that except with the threat of an outside danger. He called for a crusade, got enormous response, and the first crusade was shockingly successful. Subsequent crusades really were not, and ranged from failure to utter ridiculousness.
Yeah.
A full overview of the history of the crusades is well outside the scope of this particular podcast, and in fact, you need a pretty hefty book to really get into all the detail. But do watch that Crash Course video if you're interested, and there's a lot of interesting history that goes on during that time.
Yeah, it's certainly well worth looking into just a little bit if you have any interest in history at all. It'll give you good ideas for gaming plots, and it will also enrich your general scholarly knowledge, which is seldom a bad thing.
Almost always a good thing.
Yeah.
But the knightly orders founded as part of the Crusades really had a huge impact on Europe in a lot of different ways, and they really formed the basis for that holy warrior archetype.
There were two main orders that laid the groundwork for that. You had the Templars.
Knights Templar. And you have the Knights Hospitaller.
And we actually had to look up how to pronounce that second one, so don't feel bad if you thought it was Hospitaller. So did I until about 10 minutes before we started recording.
Yes, and I'm still only pretty sure that it's Hospitaller. The Templars get something of a bad rap, or at least get involved in far too many conspiracy theories, simply because of the power that they held in Europe and their sudden and rather shocking end. We're not going to try and do a full history of the Templars here, but they're interesting. Frankly, they're interesting to talk about. They have this very intriguing and somewhat tragic history. We call them the Knights Templar. That's a common name. They're also called the Order of the Temple, or just Templars, all of which are essentially short for
the Poor Fellow Soldiers of Christ and the Temple of Solomon.
Yes. They were founded, actually, working out of the Temple of Solomon after the First Crusade, which is where they get their name from, and were officially endorsed by the church around 1129, 1130 AD. They were organized as a monastic order. They had a strong chain of authority and were really the first group to have a strong and effective international organization. New members would actually sign over all of their worldly possessions to the order, taking vows of poverty, chastity, piety, and obedience, along with a whole sequence of precepts. It originally started out as 72 rules. As all these things do, it grew to several hundred before the Templars were disbanded. They were terrifyingly effective fighters for two reasons. First, they had a ton of money.
Which meant really good equipment, lots of horses, yes. Fine steel weapons and armor, that sort of thing.
Right, and that money is very important to their history and to their downfall, which we'll talk about in a minute here. But the other thing that was important is they were terribly effective because they were well-equipped and because they had a strict rule that not only could they not leave the field until the Knight Templar flag had fallen, they could not leave the field until the flags of all the other knightly orders had also fallen, which meant they kept fighting, and as such, were extremely effective and well-respected even by the enemy.
Just for our listeners that might not know this, generally speaking, military units will rout at about 20% casualties max. So a group that has committed to stay on the field and continue fighting regardless of their own losses until everybody else that's on their side has suffered ones at least as bad as theirs is not only remarkable, that's got to be terrifying to go up against, especially since they were apparently very good at following their own rules. Part of the reason for that is they believed that if they were killed in combat, they were automatically martyred and would go to heaven.
Yes, any dying in combat was really their goal. And in fact, the Red Templar Cross with the two points at the end of each cross was a symbol of martyrdom. That's why it was worn on their battle flags and on their uniforms. Now, what's interesting is the Templars were not founded as a military force for use in large-scale combats. They were founded to protect pilgrims on the pilgrimage routes to the Holy Land. Now, they quickly became something other than that, but that was their original intent. And they were founded on this idea of poverty. The original emblem for the Order of the Temple was two knights sharing one horse, symbolizing that these knights did not have enough money to each have their own horse. They'd given up everything in pursuit of their goals. Now, this poverty that they aimed for really didn't last very long. Very quickly, they became a favored charity for rich and poor alike. The poor would save up and give to them. Wealthy landowners and kings and nobles would give large sums to them. And not only would they give money, but they would give land and they would give over the rights to businesses. Noble sons with their own funds would join the Templars and, as such, give all of their wealth to the Templars when they joined. Secondarily, in 1139, Pope Innocent II decreed that the Order of the Temple was exempt from all local laws and answered only to the Pope, which meant that they could pass through all borders without paying any taxes, and they paid no internal taxes. They were essentially a state within a state.
So if you're following along, this means that these people are well-funded, well-equipped, have near-perfect morale, and also have essentially diplomatic immunity. It's no wonder that they got so influential so fast.
Right. What was interesting is because they were so well respected and because their services were so important, when a noble or a king left on a crusade, they handed over all of their assets to the Templars to manage. The Templars very quickly became financiers and bankers for Europe. The Templars really generated the first use of checks in Europe. Letters of credit, essentially, where a pilgrim could deposit valuables with the Templars before they embarked on their pilgrimage, carry their letter of credit with them, and retrieve those funds in the Holy Land. This was actually a lot safer for pilgrims because rather than carrying around money, they carried around letters of credit for themselves, which were of no use whatsoever to a highwayman, so it reduced the amount of crime.
Well, to say nothing of much easier to conceal than a sack of gold coins.
And easier to carry, frankly.
Yeah, sheet of paper doesn't weigh nearly as much.
Exactly. Now, the Templars went through this very sudden decline largely due to their wealth. They became somewhat unpopular amongst the nobility after the Crusades petered out. sequence of military losses, the Templars no longer had everybody's respect, and that role of a state within a state, as well as their interest in founding their own monastic state, sort of like what the Hospitallers would do in Rhodes, just raised a lot of tensions. Not to mention that by this time, the kings and nobles of Europe owed the Templars money. Kings have this nasty tendency of turning on their debtors when they have the opportunity to do so. So, in 1307, King Philip IV of France, who was deeply in debt to the Templar support infrastructure and the Templar bankers, attacked and arrested almost all of the Templars in France. A lot of other kings quickly followed suit or acted in concert with Philip. A few just sort of politely let the Templars go into hiding, but certainly didn't try and defend them. This resulted in the various nations seizing the wealth of the Templars for themselves. Templar leaders in France were tortured, most being forced to confess to various blasphemies which were used as an excuse to disband the Templars. They were officially disbanded by Pope Clement V in 1312, so they just very suddenly went from everywhere
to nowhere.
The Knights Templar, because of their disappearance, because of these rumors of devil worship and blasphemy and that sort of thing that originated kind of before the Templars were attacked, mostly because nobody particularly likes wealthy neighbors. Most of those really were the result of torture and that sort of thing. People looking, essentially,
trying to justify things after the fact.
Yes.
They had a goal in mind, and they were going to use whatever means necessary to achieve it. That's not the first time that sort of thing has happened in history, and it sadly probably will not be anywhere near the last.
No, probably not.
That sort of thing is going on in the modern world.
Yep. But those particular rumors are generally considered false by historians. But that's why you get various conspiracy theories going all the way back to the Knights Templar. They were this powerful infrastructure that suddenly disappeared. That always makes people curious and makes them interesting to talk about.
The Knights Hospitaller had a little bit better run of it.
Yeah, things turned out better for them.
Yeah, they're kind of still around today, aren't they? In a very limited way?
They are, in various forms.
Yeah. So they were founded back in 1023 by Blessed Gerard to provide care for the poor, sick, or injured pilgrims to the Holy Land. The original members worked out of a hospital in Jerusalem. So,
hence the name.
Yeah, immediately you've got kind of a little bit more of a humble origin. These people are caring for the sick and kind of people who can't really help themselves as opposed to being this kind of elite security force. And after the First Crusade, they became a chartered religious and military order that was charged with the defense of the Holy Land. So they did eventually become a little bit more militaristic, too, although I don't think they ever got anywhere near the Templars, did they, Grant?
No, they did. They were a fully established military and religious monastic order in the same way.
Let me rephrase that. Maybe they never really had the kind of fearsome reputation the Templars did.
No, I don't think they did.
They were driven from Acre to Rhodes, where they ruled as sovereigns, and then later to Malta, where they ruled as vassals of the Spanish Viceroy of Sicily. Napoleon eventually kind of scattered them.
Yep, and just think about that for a second. They were founded in 1023 and eventually scattered by Napoleon in 1798. This is an order that lasted a very long time.
Yeah, so they were founded 400 years before the New World was discovered, and there was a United States of America by the time they got scattered. Not disbanded or wiped out, scattered.
Right. They eventually repurposed themselves as a humanitarian organization, renamed themselves the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, and that Sovereign Military Order of Malta still exists to this day. They have gotten back to their humanitarian roots and run hospitals all over the world. What's interesting about this Military Order of Malta, and this is where we start finding things that we can use in role-playing games, they are recognized as a sovereign entity by 104 countries and have what are essentially embassies in 120 countries. Now, most of their holdings consists of medical centers and medical personnel and that sort of thing. Now, they sort of take on something of the same role as the Red Cross, although their role tends to be more protecting innocents and helping the sick and wounded in war zones.
Yeah. This, by the way, is almost certainly where the paladin archetype comes through.
Yes.
A protector with healing abilities who is very selfless and stands up for the innocent pretty much no matter what it costs him. Gee, that sounds just a little bit like a Knight Hospitaller. Just a teeny tiny bit.
Just little bit.
Smidge.
A little bit. Yeah. Now, if you're not Catholic, don't worry. There are Protestant branches of the Knights Hospitaller as well. There was, of course, the usual chaos in the 15th and 16th centuries as the Catholic Church and the Protestants duked it out during that time. But nowadays, those orders actually work together through a parent organization and coordinate pretty closely. There's not a lot of organizational difference between them, as near as I can tell. Now, we've talked about the Knights Hospitaller, we've talked about the Knights Templar. We could go on, but we've got things to do, like tomorrow.
Yeah, we can.
It could go a while.
We can make mention of a couple other organizations here, but then I think we probably need to get going into the rest of our episode, I mean. So there's the Swiss Guard, obviously, the Vatican's security force.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the Order of the Garter. The
Order of the Garter was founded by Edward III in England. So the question that a lot of Christians have struggled with over the centuries is, under what circumstances can a Christian go to war? Under what circumstances can a Christian do violence justly? Traditionally, in what we call just war theory, there are two primary sets of criteria for the defense of others. Do we have the right to go to war? And what is the proper conduct of Christians in a war?
And I want you to notice at the beginning of this that he did say, for the defense of others. You can't go to war just because somebody else has something that you want. That would be covetousness.
Yes, it would. The first primary Christian doctrine of just war really stems from St. Augustine in his The City of God. St. Augustine argued that although Christians should generally be pacifists, and during St. Augustine's time it was widely believed that Christians should be pacifists, pacifism did not extend to the defense of innocence. It was acceptable to engage in short-term fighting if that preserved long-term peace. This could never, however, be preemptive. You cannot say, so-and-so looks like he may be a threat, or I know so-and-so will attack someone. You can only do this, engage in this sort of fighting, on a purely defensive basis. Now, St. Thomas Aquinas further refined this into three basic precepts. First, war must occur for a good and just purpose rather than for self-gain, which is what Peter just talked about, or as an exercise of power. Things like in the nation's interest do not count. Those are essentially weasel words around self-gain. Secondly, a just war must be waged by a properly instituted authority. Now, that can be the state, but it can't just be a mob. There has to be some sort of organization and somebody with the right to go to war and declare that violence is acceptable.
And this is one of those things where things like formal declarations of war come in rather than just attacking via surprise. A lot of the rules of honorable combat, I think, have some of their roots in this.
Yes. Now, third, peace must be a central motive even in the midst of violence. You can't fight for the sake of winning. Fighting must happen in order to restore peace, to guarantee peace in the long term, and if there is an offer to return to a peaceful state, that must be seriously considered and accepted, if at all possible. Now, over the centuries, there were further refinements of these Thomistic principles, and later theologians developed a few more standards. Essentially, what they argue is that a war is neither legitimate nor illegitimate, purely based off motivation. It has to comply with some extra standards. First, the response to an attack must be commensurate. The use of more violence than is strictly necessary inherently constitutes unjust war.
And if you go back and apply this to the seven classical deadly sins, you shouldn't be under wrath while you're raging war.
Yes.
If you are employing more violence than is necessary to achieve peace, you're looking at vengeance rather than defense or justice.
Right. Oh, I don't remember the movie, but on a more personal level, the old adage of he pulls a knife, you pull a gun, that's the Chicago way. That inherently implies using more violence than is really necessary to resolve the situation.
An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth leaves the whole world blind and unable to chew.
Yes. Now, second criteria for just war. Governing authorities may declare war, but a declaration of war is not in and of itself sufficient cause for war. Interestingly, if the people oppose a war, then that war is also illegitimate, and the people have a right to depose a government which wages or is about to wage an unjust war. Third, once war has begun, Christian moral limits remain in place. You cannot attack innocents, you cannot kill hostages, etc. You still have to behave as a Christian.
This is where things like the coat of arms comes in.
Coat of arms, as we'll talk about with various character archetypes.
Paladin's code of honor.
And Paladin's code of honor, accepting the surrender of enemies, that sort of thing.
Yep.
Fourth, war is only legitimate as a last resort. Before going to war, all other options must first be exhausted. Negotiations need to be tried first before going to war. It's interesting to note that under this doctrine, expansionist wars, wars for pillage and loot, wars to convert infidels or pagans...
Let's go back to that one for a second. You cannot convert people with fire and sword under this doctrine.
Right, which is interesting because one of the stereotypes of the Crusader is that he's doing just that.
Yep.
Likewise, wars for glory are also inherently unjust. Again, the idea of fighting for God and glory is an inherent part of that Crusader archetype that is not valid under just war doctrine. Just war theory is one of several reasons that people have gone to war. The Bible in particular is full of direct verbal instructions from God, often speaking to judges or to Joshua, speaking through priests, speaking through prophets like Samuel to David, telling warriors to
oppose a particular enemy.
Yes, to fight for a just cause, fight for the protection of Israel. In those cases, I think we can safely say that war is inherently just. This is not strictly limited to the Old Testament. Even people like Joan of Arc supposedly received direct verbal instructions from God, or I believe in Joan's case, the Archangel Michael supposedly led her to war.
There's been plenty of times where people have claimed a divine mandate as a reason to conquer, pillage, and commit atrocities. The Spanish conquistadors are probably the most egregious example of that.
Yes, and even in popular literature about the Crusades, like Walter Scott's Ivanhoe, the Templars act in that way in many cases.
When a bunch of people scream Deus Vult, which means God wills it, before they ride down a bunch of innocents, that's exactly what they're doing.
Crusaders have featured fairly heavily in fiction. I just mentioned Ivanhoe by Sir Walter Scott. They feature in all sorts of novels and books, and the archetype appears even when not specifically speaking of crusaders.
I think actually one of the other more prominent literary examples of this archetype is Sir Galahad from King Arthur's Knights of the Round Table.
Uh-huh.
Most of King Arthur's knights would probably fit this archetype in its non-corrupt, very just, noble incarnation, but Sir Galahad in particular was depicted as a knight of truly uncommon virtue, purity, decency. He was known as the Good Knight. Consider, you know, that he was being called that out of this whole group of people who were basically unquestionably heroic and admirable individuals.
By and large, yeah.
Who largely acted in a selfless and courageous manner to defend Britannia. That's pretty remarkable. Some other fictional examples, Solomon Kane, Robert E. Howard's wandering Puritan avenger. Although, I don't know, he's
pretty swashbuckly in some
ways. Yeah, he's not as much of a knight. He's a little too modern. There's one very modern example in Michael Carpenter from Jim Butcher's The Dresden Files.
Yes, the Knight of the Sword.
Yeah, I actually haven't even read too much about him, but
he appears in the third book. I've read up through book three.
Okay.
Yeah.
The one quote from him that I always hear that I think is really cool is, "My faith protects me, the Kevlar helps."
Maybe most famously in terms of geek fiction and fantasy, Aragorn and Faramir from The Lord of the Rings are classically considered to have that knight role, especially Faramir. Aragorn, a little less so, but when he joins them on the field of battle, he sort of steps into that role.
Yeah, obviously both profoundly upright and virtuous characters who
yes.
are very capable on the battlefield.
To video games, Templars feature fairly heavily everywhere. Dragon Age, in fact, specifically calls them out as Templars, these members of a knightly order.
Although they're
heavily armored.
They're kind of interesting. They report directly to a church and stuff, but they have a role that's very different in the Dragon Age series than they did in the real world. They're set up as kind of an internal affairs division over mage colleges. they keep an eye on everybody who can use magic in the setting to make sure that they're not becoming corrupted. Or there's actually, in the Dragon Age setting, for those unfamiliar with it, there's an actual very real danger of a mage turning into not just a metaphorical monster, but an actual horrific rampaging monster if they dabble in the wrong kinds of magic. So the Templars are in place to either keep that from happening or to put down the offending mage if it does as quickly as possible. Now, because Dragon Age is such a morally gray series, the Templars in there may not be the very best virtuous examples. They like to play with a lot of corruption, fuzzy motivations, that sort of thing in the stories in Dragon Age. But there's a few examples of them, or I'm actually thinking of one particular example of a former member of the Order, Alistair, who is very definitely a shining example of how this can be a really neat, very noble character.
Sure.
He's very wisecracking, but
yeah,
he's also probably, out of all of the characters that yours can have following around, probably a toss-up between him and Wynn, the mage that you pick up about halfway through, depending on how you're playing, as to who's the most moral, but he's definitely one of the two top contenders.
Yeah, I like Wynn, though. Wynn's fun.
Yeah, she is. She's got that kind of stern grandmotherly thing going on.
Yeah, let's see. Oh, two others that we did want to mention, too. Warhammer Fantasy Witch Hunters, which I'm not terribly familiar with Warhammer Fantasy.
They're very much like the Solomon Kane archetype. Once again, they're a little more swashbuckly. They're not quite as perfect of an example. And then there's the Warhammer 40K Space Marines, which most of them are just elite troops, but if you look at the Grey Knights in particular, their whole job is basically hunting down demons in space, so they would definitely qualify.
I really think the Space Marines qualify better than that, because their job is to take territory. We're talking about the Crusader archetype here. Their job is to take territory, defend humanity from external threats, fight in the name of the God Emperor. They call their campaigns Crusades, even.
Yeah.
And they are warriors in heavy armor, elite soldiers supplied by
a very religiously steeped order.
And supplied by the work of peasants. There's a lot of manpower that goes into equipping each one, much like a real-world knight.
Or any elite military unit.
Yes.
A lot gets said about how formidable Special Forces guys are on the field of battle, but one of the things that almost never gets brought up by anybody who hasn't actually served in the military is that those guys require just a huge network of support staff and enablers to make sure that they're as effective as they can be. They have to get in, they have to get out, they have to be supplied, they've got armorers, medical staff, training personnel. There's a lot of people that support those.
Mm-hmm. It's very true. So, we've talked about fictional archetypes and fictional examples. In role-playing games, this same archetype shows up in various different forms. D&D has really had it since the beginning. Crusaders and Paladins. Clerics, I think, qualify if they are the armor and mace-wielding cleric, less so the quiet spellcaster.
Yeah, there's a variety of other divinely powered warrior-type classes in various forms of D&D. We made a pretty substantial list, but all we'd be doing if we went through it is rattling off a bunch of class names. And if you want to listen to people rattling off lists, I'm sure there's a podcast totally dedicated to that. That's not going to be us, though.
Not us, no. We've talked about the Knight of the Sword in Dresden Files. There's the Testament setting for D&D 3rd Edition, which is essentially role-playing in the biblical era.
So in that case, you can have some of the original origins of this archetype, Judean warrior, possibly even part of Joshua's army, as a player character, because you're actually depicting stories that took place during that time.
Right. A game that you've talked about before in Nomine.
Yeah, there's an archetype called a soldier in that, which is basically a human that is aware of the war between heaven and hell firsthand, who has been recruited by the good guys, typically the more militant archangels like Michael or David, has some minor divine abilities, and has dedicated himself to fighting the depredations of hell on earth.
And interestingly, you might qualify every player character in Dogs in the Vineyard as having something like this role. Dogs in the Vineyard defies a lot of archetypes and a lot of pigeonholing, but you could make a case for that.
You know, actually, let's take a couple of seconds and talk about the characters in Dogs in the Vineyard, because I think this is one where you've got this archetype used in a really interesting way in a type of setting that you wouldn't normally see it in.
Sure, we can do that. I know we've talked about Dogs in the Vineyard before without really explaining the game and the setting to anybody who hasn't played it.
So basically, Dogs in the Vineyard is, I guess, a religiously motivated Western is probably a good way to start off describing it. And remember, this is the one that we mentioned in a previous episode, which is Mormons in Utah with the serial numbers filed off.
Yes.
The Dogs are a group of teenagers. I believe they start recruiting them at about 16, and they're generally out of the order by the time they're 21.
Something like that.
Who are recruited as basically a religious and moral police force for the area. They're given special clothing, weapons, a little bit of specialized training, and they're sent out to look for signs of corruption and trouble in the territories.
And this can range from arguments between neighbors to serious social and moral problems in a community to demonic possession and activity tearing up a town.
To just bandits.
Yeah. The whole point of the game is to throw players and player characters into interesting moral problems.
And see how they react.
Right. And you do so by essentially giving every player character the right to do almost anything they wish. If you want to solve a dispute between neighbors by shooting one of them dead.
Or both of them, for that matter.
The game will say, all right, problem solved. And it's up to you to say, boy, I don't know if I solved that the right way or not.
Yeah.
And learn from that.
It's important to note that consequences are very much a part of the game, too.
Mm-hmm.
Both for the player characters and for the people around them. So it's not just an escapist power fantasy. It's the way that it's constructed. And I think the thing that made it such an interesting game that I'd really like to play someday, to me, was you have something that, on the face of it, could just be an escapist power fantasy, and then, like, everything in the game, both mechanically and flavor-wise, is geared to make it not that.
Right. It provides plenty of freedom of player action, with constraints put on the player by both the setting and the player's own sense of right and wrong, which is a pretty powerful way to write a game.
Yeah. So we've discussed some archetypes of varying levels of fittingness, and we've given some historical background. Should we get into some of the missions that you might find this kind of character
on? Yeah, I mean, we've kind of talked about characters as they appear in RPGs. Let's talk about what you might want to do with a crusader in a role-playing game. And let's go ahead and talk about what they actually do. There are certain tasks that are commonly associated with the crusader, the first one of which is, of course, the crusade, the idea of religious conquest and religious reclamation. And it is always framed, or almost always framed, as reclaiming territory, people, cities, holy sites, whatever it is, reclaiming something from some other entity.
Now, obviously in history, this got into some pretty unpleasant moral territory, but if you're doing a fantasy game, it's pretty easy to make this quite obviously righteous if you want to. You can be going in to reclaim an area that's been overrun by, for example, an army of undead or some other sort of monster. There's actually a spot in the Pathfinder setting, the world of Galarian, where there's basically a rift into hell that has got a constant supply of crusader types going in to beat back the darkness and keep it from spilling over into the rest of the world. So that's very definitely an option for a role-playing scenario.
It doesn't necessarily have to be something like that.
Yeah, it needn't be quite that dramatic.
Yeah, even something as simple as reclaiming territory from an empire, fighting them on a front, something like that. I'm thinking of the wars in Spain, pushing the Islamic Empire, pushing them back. It took, I think, 100 or 200 years for the Moors to be completely pushed out of Spain by the Spanish European forces there. It can take a while, and you can tell some interesting, you know, war front stories in a situation like that, but it doesn't have to be individual heroic stories. It can be part of a larger military expedition. That's certainly an interesting story to tell. Likewise, crusaders often involve themselves in uniting a populace or uniting multiple populaces against a common enemy.
And of course, the most dramatic and well-known example of this in fantasy is the world uniting against Sauron in Lord of the Rings.
Sure.
Or at least attempting to.
Yeah, yeah. That's a classic example right there. Again, historically, Pope Urban II using the Turks' conquest of the Holy Land as a way to unite Europe. There are plenty of other fictional examples. The original role of the Templars makes for an interesting mission or an adventure, protecting travelers and pilgrims.
And this is one of those things where tabletop role-playing is usually a lot nicer for this than an RPG on a computer, because the dreaded escort quest is no fun in a video game. It can be incredibly interesting in a tabletop type of setting, because when you're going from point A to point B, first of all, you don't have to do it in such a way where the players can be done with it in just a few short minutes, because you've got a limited amount of time before they're just going to quit your game and uninstall it. So the players can get to know the people that they're escorting. You can walk through interesting places. There's a lot of stuff that you can do when you're acting as security besides just fighting off threats to whatever it is that you're trying to secure. And I think those additional elements of exploration, both literal and character-wise, are really going to make a Crusader type of character a little more interesting. Because a lot of the time, these are kind of rightly thought of as these one-dimensional cardboard cutouts.
Oftentimes they are.
They tend to get portrayed that way both by players and by authors. So if you walk through like an ancient, possibly ruined or abandoned holy site on your way to wherever it is that you're going, or have some kind of natural beauty or something that creates an epiphany, have one of the people that you're escorting start leaning on the Crusader character because they're part of this order, so they must be more mature in their faith. Have them start asking tough questions of morality and theology in a sincere way, not just to mock them, and see how the character responds. Those lengthy escort missions can provide a lot of rich role-playing material if you let them.
Sure. I mean, I can envision an entire campaign right now of people protecting a merchant caravan and caravan of pilgrims going from point A to point B, and having relationships with them and dealing with external threats and waypoints and their order on the way, that sort of thing. It would be an interesting campaign. I don't know if it would last incredibly long, but it could very well be a very nice, tidy story to wrap up.
I totally want to run that now, or play in it.
All right.
That sounds really cool.
I'll add that to the list of games I need to run.
Yeah, me too.
Awesome.
Then, of course, there's Purifying Evil from the Land. We touched on that a little bit, kind of back in the beginning with the Crusade. When you have something that's corrupting the land itself, obviously, that's a good time to call in the Holy Knights. Defending threatened innocence is something that most heroic characters will do, but it's kind of a Crusader's job description.
It is. It defines them in many ways. The New Testament verse that we picked out for the podcast is really for this in particular, this primary role of the Crusader. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. That's what a Crusader should do, what a holy warrior should do if it comes right down to it.
And the classical image here is a lone knight standing at a bridge as the evil army comes crashing towards him with all the people that the knight was trying to defend fleeing down the bridge, and he's going to hold it for as long as he can so they can get away.
Yep.
He has no expectation of survival, but the people he was protecting will be saved.
If you ever need one of these Crusader characters to go out with a bang, find a moment like that.
Yeah.
It'll almost always be powerful.
And the player that's going to play a character like that will almost certainly take that as like, okay, this is like the best possible way for this character to go out. He successfully gave his life defending a group of innocents. This character can put in the halls of fame for my role-playing history, and that's kind of cool.
We've touched a little bit on Crusaders as troops in a conventional war. You can do it. I think you may be giving up a little bit to do it, but you know, it's a possibility.
The one real-world example that I can think of here is Alvin York from World War I, conscientious objector who got drafted and wound up, I believe he got a Congressional Medal of Honor. He was a frighteningly good marksman. He basically held off a German advance single-handedly for quite a while, killed a lot of them in the process, and when he was asked about it later, he said that he had done it to save more lives than he had to take in battle. He was a deeply religious man. I believe he was a Quaker? Am I getting that right?
Yes, I believe that's right. If I remember it correctly, yes, he was a Quaker.
Very interesting person, very kind-hearted and humble, but boy, he was good with a rifle.
I suppose if you're doing a traditional sort of role-playing game, your standard adventuring party gets involved in a lot of covert operations, and those are not entirely outside the archetype of the Crusader.
Particularly its Old Testament version, as we've alluded to in that. the judge Ehud in the Book of Judges concealing a weapon and going in and assassinating a tyrant.
Mm-hmm.
That's about as covert as operations got in the ancient world.
Yes.
There's certainly a place for some of that in a crusader-type character's life, provided that their motivations are pure.
Motivations are pure and that they live up to the other parts of their creed.
Yeah, there's really nothing in that just war theory that prescribes particular tactics other than things like atrocities and weapons of mass destruction, I would argue.
Mm-hmm. And I think it might be safe to say that if you have the choice between a covert operation that will quickly bring peace and a drawn-out battle that will kill hundreds or thousands, it may be within that theory of just war.
I would actually say under the theory of just war, it's a moral imperative to take the covert operation.
I think so, too.
Do the thing that causes the least amount of loss of life, even if it's a little bit sneaky and underhanded, and
right.
wind up with a peace that's less costly in the long run.
Yeah, if you have, you know, a glory-seeking knightly crusader, giving him that choice makes for an interesting moment for that character where he's got his inherent lust for glory and honor conflicting with his duty to quickly and peacefully end a conflict. It's an interesting thing to explore. And finally, if we're talking about things that these crusaders do, we'd be somewhat remiss if we didn't mention the quest for the Holy Grail.
Yes.
Or the Indiana Jones search for the Ark of the Covenant.
Or the Spear of Longinus, or parts of the True Cross, or various other holy relics that knights have gone questing for in
yes.
history and in mythology. Kind of like the guarding the pilgrims, this is something where you can really have a lot of fun and some really cool and powerful moments with this in a role-playing game if you do a little bit of preparation, or I suppose if you think on your feet fast enough as a GM. A lot of the time, the relics themselves have very interesting histories, or they wouldn't be a relic at all.
Right.
The places that they tend to be found in are either these wonderful, beautiful old holy sites, or they're like in this very dangerous place out in the middle of nowhere where they've been taken from these beautiful old holy sites. You can run into a lot of interesting characters that both kind of on the moral side that want to see it recovered, or the more profiteering type that may be looking to steal this and sell it or something. So,
yes, and of course the traditional supernatural guardians, which are always interesting to deal with.
Or the supernatural powers of the relic itself, if it has them, can be interesting too.
Yes.
So, do we want to get into the specific uses of this character archetype in games beyond just the missions that they go on?
Let's at least talk about them as protagonists in general. Do we have anything that we need to talk about with how they play, how Christians should play them, that sort of thing?
You know, I've played a lot of this particular archetype over the years. In fact, I would say this is probably my favorite type of character to play. There's a variety of reasons for that. I like the idea of being the moral center of the adventuring party that my character's in.
Mm-hmm.
I like a lot of their mechanical abilities in D&D in particular, which I've played a lot of. They've got some ability to help people who need it. They've got some ability to fight off bad guys. They typically have access to an interesting organization that can make for some good role-playing. There's a lot to work with if you're playing this kind of a character.
Right.
And I've always kind of appreciated that. I think the other thing, too, that I didn't always do, I've done this a little bit more in recent years, is that when you're playing this kind of a character, the moral expectations that they have of themselves and that others have of them are incredibly high. And rightly so, really. They should be an example. And the struggles to live up to that, to always do the right thing in every situation and always know what the right thing is at the drop of a hat, first of all, is very stressful, but stress is conflict and conflict makes for good role playing. So if you're playing one of these, that can be an interesting thing to explore
mm-hmm.
and use as a vector for character development.
Sure. I'll tell you, that's actually one of the reasons I have trouble with the archetype, which is funny because I play a lot of clerics and cleric-like characters. But the crusader who just instinctively knows what the right thing is and does it, I actually have a lot of trouble with. Partly because I tend to be very analytical when playing games. I have to sit there and think, okay, what's the right course of action? What course of action would my character take? That sort of thing. And those snap decisions do not come naturally to me as a player. So is there a trick to that, or is it just going off your own gut instinct and translating that to your character, or what?
There's some of that. Probably somewhat ironically, I know enough about GMing tricks where I sometimes watch the cards, not the hands, to use a three-card Monty analogy. you've got this, this, and this element in the story, so the GM is probably trying to do this or this, which means that this choice actually means this, and this one actually means that. Plus, also, I'm a very improv, think on your feet, don't really come in with a plan kind of GM. So I've got a lot of experience thinking very quickly at the gaming table.
Okay, that makes sense. I'm very notes heavy, so that might be part of the distinction there.
The other thing, too, that I do try and keep in mind is, while I generally try and get at least somewhat emotionally invested in my characters, if I make the wrong decision, that's interesting story and nobody was actually hurt.
Yeah, that's an important thing.
So keeping that in the back of my mind, knowing that there are no real life stakes to this, makes it easier to play a character who acts with that kind of moral certainty. Does that make any sense?
That makes good sense. That's good advice in general, really. Improv is always tough for me. I don't do it terribly well, which I realize is weird for somebody who plays role-playing games, but it's very hard for me to act in front of others and to just make those snap decisions and just run with it and hope things work out.
I should also note that I'm just kind of a fast thinker anyways, so I can plan a lot in a short period of time. It's not necessarily always going to be a good plan.
Right.
But it will be a plan.
Right. You have something. That's something.
Yeah.
There's sort of this traditional opinion of paladins. I'm thinking specifically of D&D paladins. Specifically the opinion that everybody else has about the paladin, that he's a lawful, annoying, stick-in-the-mud character. Is there anything to that in your experience? It may depend on the group, I realize.
Yeah, I've deliberately tried to not make the characters that I've played like that.
Mm-hmm.
The one that I mentioned, I think it was back in episode 0, the Lord Soth with no memory character.
Yeah.
Actually started out as this very tortured, grim PTSD soldier who's seen the horrors of war and kind of went from there. So he definitely wasn't that. The last one that I played in a very short-lived Skype game a while ago was, to make a long story short and not to dig too far into a gaming story, he was kind of an undercover one, so he couldn't be like that. He had to seem like just normal noble. He acted in the way that you would expect a very upright and decent person with a fair amount of temporal wealth and authority to act.
Okay.
I kind of went for the good king archetype with him when he was in noble society and then when he was out on missions where he would actually wear a mask. I kind of reverted to almost the spy archetype. He was very pragmatic and very prone to using, kind of like we discussed when we were getting into the just war theory stuff, he would go for whatever was the most efficient way to get rid of whatever evil was causing the threat at the time with the least amount of disruption to society and the least danger to innocent people.
Gotcha.
Which a lot of the time meant some cloak and dagger, sneak in and assassinate the bad guys kind of operations.
Huh. All right.
He was interesting. I've played a few that were just kind of knight-errant characters. I tried to at least make them friendly. I think if you want to avoid the whole, like, lawful, annoying, stick-in-the-mud thing, just try and make the person somebody that you'd want to sit down to a meal with.
Right.
We've all got people in our lives who we look up to morally, grandparents or whatever, that still have a sense of humor, that still don't glare at everybody for everything, that can laugh when they see children playing and being children instead of doing the stern library and smack a ruler on the desk and scowl thing.
That's fair.
And, you know, if all else fails, play Dragon Age Origins and take notes as to what Alistair does.
Yeah, that might be some of my problem. The paladins that have been in my D&D games have fallen into the annoying part, at least at first. The one I'm thinking of in my Birthright game kind of grew out of that, and as we all sort of developed the characters some. Started off as that a little bit.
He was an I disapprove of everything character.
Yes. That's as good a summation as I want to do on this particular podcast without getting into long character stories. Yes.
Well, and there's actually a piece of scripture that will apply there.
Even better.
That, I think, is Christ's admonition to take the plank out of your own eye before you go searching for specks in other people's.
Yeah.
And if you try and keep that in mind, where, okay, so if your paladin character operates under the assumption that at any given moment in time he's got a plank in his eye, it's not really appropriate to go and try and remove something from somebody else's eye unless they have an entire tree in there.
Yes. No, that's good advice. I think that's a good way to not fall into the stereotypical paladin role, I suppose. I like it.
On the other hand, if you're going for a very lighthearted, somewhat humorous game,
mm-hmm.
play the annoying and lawful aggravating paladin to the hilt.
Yeah, that works.
Don't you know it's wrong to wear blue on Tuesday?
Right.
What?
Yes.
Wait, where? What?
Yes.
Wait, where's that coming from? And then just have him quote some obscure writing by some, like, obscure religious figure of his faith that's not even considered to be particularly authoritative.
Oh, sure. No, you just make it up as you go.
And just watch all the other characters face palm.
Just make it up as you go along. That's really the way to do it in a game like that. You know, actually, somebody like that who's very much on the law and order and here are the rules and the rules do not deviate, they might make a good, if somewhat tragic, antagonist for characters as well.
Sure. That's the other prevailing stereotype of this character type, right?
Yeah.
You've got the good and upright stick in the mud, or you've got the rules matter than anything else, innocent life included.
Or the rules are an excuse for us to do what we want. We were talking about conquistadors as sort of how not to do it.
Yeah.
There's tales of conquistadors having strict rules that if the natives in the Americas converted to Christianity, they couldn't be killed, you couldn't take their stuff. They were part of the Christian Spanish Empire, and so they would stand on a hill, well out of earshot usually, of the town they were about to try and convert, read off the proclamation in Spanish, saying that if they converted, they would be safe. Wait for a moment. Nope, none of them converted. Let's go kill them and take their stuff.
Yeah.
You have the rules, but through willful manipulation of those rules, you can still end up with some very evil acts, no matter how well-intentioned those rules actually are. And a character like that, who works sort of within the framework of the rules, but obviously bends them in ways that really irritates your players or really
horrifies
makes your character say, oh, that's really awful.
Yeah.
Makes for, I think, a pretty good villain if you can pull it off.
Well, and to go back to your C.S. Lewis quote from the other episode, a lot of the time one of the things that makes these characters so incredibly terrifying is that they are in complete denial about what sort of a person they are.
Oh, sure. They think they're doing good, or they think what they're doing is somehow justified.
And the worst and most terrifying example of this is they are so convinced of their own righteousness that I'm doing it is all the justification that's needed because they think they cannot make an immoral decision.
Right. At the absolute worst, yes.
That is the sin of pride at its apex, and it is terrifying.
It really is, and leads to enormous pain. The other advantage to a antagonist like that is if you have your group of characters, they have an external antagonist. Some force that's threatening something they care about, their society, the girl, whatever it is. But you also have this internal antagonist who's creating difficulties for them within the society they're trying to protect.
Yeah.
And that dichotomy, I think, may help accentuate the other danger. And it gives, if we're going to steal a phrase from our buddy Aaron Stack here, give people petty little victories as they overcome him as well as this external threat. And certainly I think having an antagonist like this could very well serve as a major villain for a campaign as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially if you're doing a campaign of trying to reclaim an organization or trying to redeem it or something like that.
Yeah.
It could be a lot of fun.
If you've got an organization that's made up of mostly people who have fallen from the path and gone to the conquistador end of the spectrum, it would be a very, probably emotionally draining, but a really satisfying campaign to start out with people that were much closer to the hospitaller end of the spectrum, trying to save the entire organization from itself.
Yeah.
You know, we're the 9 honest cops in Gotham City. What do we do? You know?
There's a book by Dave Duncan. It's a piece of fiction, part of a trilogy, that actually is sort of along those lines. It's an interesting series, in some ways really good and in some ways really frustrating, because it relies heavily on Deus Ex Machina, which is a little irritating, but the characters are really interesting, and the conceit behind the series is interesting. But the whole first book is really about someone coming in and redeeming an entire order of religious and semi-religious warriors who are there to protect a temple.
That sounds incredibly cool. I'll have to look that up.
It's pretty good. It's The Reluctant Swordsman. Dave Duncan, don't remember when he wrote it or anything, but it's an interesting book, and I would recommend it, especially if you're looking for how these things might play out and the kind of resistance you might get when doing something like this. It's a really interesting book in a lot of ways.
How long is the series, out of curiosity?
three books.
I have to get that from work.
You should.
Yes, listeners, I work for a bookstore.
There's a reason he gives me all sorts of good book recommendations.
I don't know. I think we're about even on that scale right now.
I don't know about that. I've got a stack of books that I haven't read yet that you recommended.
If we even out the fiction and nonfiction lists, I think it's pretty even.
All right. Fair enough.
I recommend more nonfiction and you recommend more fiction. I think we're about square if we do it that way.
Yeah, I think so. And then again, I read more fiction. So at any rate, let's see. We've talked about protagonists. We've talked about antagonists.
So one of the other things is a lot of the time there's a Black Knight or Anti-Paladin or Blackguard, or they go by a bunch of other names, but there's basically an evil version of this that you basically just see in fantasy. And we don't really want to spend a whole lot of time talking about this because they do tend to be kind of intentionally actually one-dimensional characters. But it can be interesting to have some of them in your story too, where you've got this character that takes power from an evil source, who is fully aware of that, and who is basically committed to a life of ruin and suffering. A lot of the time these would be very damaged people, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And they make the perfect arch nemesis for a player character who's trying to exemplify the virtuous version
yep.
of this archetype.
Yeah, if you want a good example of this from fantasy fiction, Marcel, sort of the counterpart to Sparhawk in David Eddings.
I think it was Martell, actually.
Martell, yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, Martell is a great example of a counterpoint. And what's interesting about these Blackguard knights is they are almost always fallen from the original order.
Yeah.
Or fallen from the protagonist's order in some way. They are a traitor knight. In fact, again, if we want to go all the way to Warhammer 40K, you have the traitor legions of the Empire who've turned to chaos.
Yep.
Knights fighting on the other side, and all the more terrifying because they are traitors.
I think it probably bears a few minutes of discussion, although we are running pretty long in this episode.
It's all right.
Of what kind of organizational structure these characters are from. When we were discussing this prior to the show, we came up with basically two ways that you can handle the Holy Order that these characters tend to be part of. You've got the principles-based one, where the organization's charter is basically just uphold these virtues, full stop.
Right.
This works incredibly well for a really pure and righteous example of this. It works even better if they're somewhat monastic and they're contemplative and scholarly. The mental image that comes to mind is the knight on his horse slowly riding along at it, just a slow trot to wherever he's going. His shield is hung off one side of his saddle. His sword is sheathed. His helmet's probably resting on the little knob on his saddle. And
the pommel?
Yeah, the pommel. Thank you. And he's got a book propped open on his helmet, and it's a holy text, and he's reading it as he rides along. He's just trying to make sure that he's staying true to his principles.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very humble picture.
Yep. Usually, if we're talking about an organization here, something like that would lend itself to a looser organization.
Yep. It will almost certainly be totally voluntary. A lot of the time, it would probably be with no particular length of service in mind, or one that is not intended to be lifelong. And so the people that stay in it year after year after year are really...
usually the devout.
Yeah. They're the devout, but beyond that, they're also these morally impressive people that have a lot of quiet humility to them. And you just kind of know that these are the just and the righteous by interacting with them. And then there's the other side of the coin, which is more goals-based.
Sure, and that's where you have an organization devoted to a particular task. Again, to use our historical example of the Templars, protecting pilgrims along pilgrimage routes. And they're going to tend to be, I think, more organized because they have a task to accomplish and need to have logistical arrangements made to accomplish that task ahead of time.
And this kind of organization can obviously get a lot more done because they're more organized. They can marshal resources quickly. They can send things down the chain of command. They can get people moving quickly, efficiently, and with united purpose.
Sure.
But with that kind of bureaucratic chain of command structure also comes an increased potential for corruption, I think.
It does. If you're making a player character who comes from something like this, you need to figure out how they have freedom of action, if they have that at all.
Yeah. Or if they don't have much freedom of action, you're going to have to work closely with your GM to make sure that what it is that they're doing tends to keep them with the party, except for maybe when it would be dramatically appropriate for them to not be able to be with the party every once in a while.
That creates an interesting tension, and those tensions are valuable for a character, but it's something that can be kind of a pain if you don't plan for it.
Yeah, it can also derail a campaign if it gets too obtrusive.
Yeah, you don't want that. Oh no, my character can't do that can stop the campaign pretty quickly if you're trying to make sure everybody gets to play.
Yeah. So. On the other hand, if the character doesn't have to go off and do whatever it is alone, it can sometimes be interesting if his holy order commands him to do something, and the person that he takes with him is one of the more morally muddy characters in the party. Typically, it would be like the thief or something. He either has to take this person for some reason because he needs his skills, he wants to keep an eye on him, or possibly most interestingly, he's trying to improve this person and wants to take them with and is cultivating a relationship. That could make for some really good dramatic moments.
That could be a lot of fun.
Well, Grant, I think we've pretty much covered this one. What do you think?
Yeah, that and more, probably.
I think with that, we're going to call it a night, folks.
Yes.
Thank you for listening.
Take it easy. And again, a quick reminder, like us on Facebook, go to our website, savingthegamepodcast.org.
Follow us on Twitter.
On Google+, any of our social media. We're on iTunes now. So keep up and share the podcast around to those you think who might enjoy it. And if you have any suggestions, please feel free to contact us on any of those media that we just gave you.
We love hearing from our listeners.
Yes, we really do.
So if you've got anything to say to us, please say it.
Yeah, it's one of the things that really keeps us going.
Yeah, hearing from you guys is one of the things that keeps us going.
So on that note, folks, I'm going to wish you all a good evening. God bless, and take it easy. This has been a production of Saving the Game, copyright 2012. This podcast may be redistributed under a Creative Commons non-commercial, non-derivative license, provided that credit is given to savingthegamepodcast.org. Our music is by Ryan Humphrey. For past episodes, podcast news from our hosts, or to connect with us, visit our website at savingthegamepodcast.org. God bless, and happy gaming.